Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It, produced by Foundersuite.com. Today I have Pat Larson, CEO of Zen Ledger, coming to us from Seattle. How's your day going, Pat?
It's going great. Thanks, Nathan. Happy to be here.
Let's get right to it. What do you guys do?
Yeah, sure. We're a software company, and we help individual investors and CPAs with their cryptocurrency accounting and tax returns. So typical cryptocurrency investor does a lot of trades across multiple exchanges, and it becomes a bit of a headache to keep it all straight and then to do the proper accounting on it to know what your capital gain or capital loss was. And so we help bring all that trading activity together across exchanges and wallets and auto-populate several tax forms for you, the A949, Schedule D, and also a comprehensive spreadsheet that ties everything together as like Bitcoin, you know, fractionates as you make investments. So like for a CPA, we're kind of like a new revenue stream because a lot of CPAs aren't doing cryptocurrency tax returns yet. And a big source of automation. And then for individuals, again, it's a big time saver, but then also, peace of mind.
I'm thinking about a crypto investor. I'm jumping in and out maybe constantly into different currencies and kind of arbitraging and playing the spread and all that stuff. Giving any data on like how frequent these, your typical customers trading?
Yeah, I mean, some of our customers have 50,000 trades, so incredibly active. They're like a mini hedge fund onto themselves, a high frequency, hedge fund. So it's all time stamped. It's all structured data, and we compare, what's on public blockchains and then also what's in your exchange data and marry that up so that we fill in holes. A lot of times when you move cryptocurrency across exchanges, some exchange will say, oh, you're leaving our platform. We're going to label that as a taxable sale. It's the most conservative treatment for us as an exchange, whereas actually it's a non-taxable transfer. So we look for things like that and back them out to, help an individual with their taxes. And then again, like we collate everything and aggregate it so that you can see like, oh, I sold one Bitcoin. It got fractionated into like 10 different transactions, and then we bring it back together so you can see, and they'll overlap, right? If you sell like one Bitcoin over just inside 10 seconds, it'll get very messy very quickly, and we bring it all together for you.
It's interesting, and kind of getting into a boring accounting question, but if I buy two Bitcoin, one in, January of 2018 and one in August of 2018, and then I sell one, mm-hmm. Am I picking which Bitcoin I'm selling? Because they might have different cost bases, right?
Yeah.
How does that work?
So our software will let you pick between LIFO and FIFO, which is last in, first out, or first in, first out. We think the more conservative approach is first in, first out. So if you sold out of that two Bitcoin, if you sold 1.1 Bitcoin, we would eat up the one from January 1st and then the 0.1 from August. That's how we would default to doing it. But if you and your CPA decided that LIFO was more beneficial, then you could make that selection. There's just so much gray area in how the IRS is going to tax us now. And the IRS and SEC and Congress are actually all going back and forth, pointing fingers at each other, saying, you do it. It actually probably requires Congress to write laws. And that means it requires companies to spend money on lobbying to get this done. And we're not quite there yet.
And so where did you come up with this idea? What were you doing before this? Were you in the Bitcoin trading world, or were you an accountant, doing taxes for for folks?
Neither. Which should frighten you. So like my background is I went to the Air Force Academy for undergrad and studied chemistry, and then I was a Navy search and rescue helicopter pilot, and I did a couple tours, and then I came and I got my MBA at University of Chicago, Booth School of Business, and I focused on accounting and finance. With an entrepreneurial track as well. And I became an M&A investment banker. And then after that, I've been in tech for about 6 years. I was a business manager at Amazon. I ran licensed sporting goods there. which was like $100 million business. There's no small businesses in Amazon. And then I've been in a couple startups, usually as like kind of a business development guy, but also like business consulting, scrum master type. So about a year ago, I was stepping away from an e-commerce startup and taking a step back and thinking, you know, where's the forefront of technology? Where do I want to spend my time? I don't want to become pigeonholed in e-commerce. And so I kind of just did a big survey, talked to a bunch of friends in tech. You know, I'd known about cryptocurrencies for quite a while and dabbled in them, but hadn't thought seriously about building a business there. But over, you know, the summer of 2017, Coinbase was being sued by the IRS. The ICO craze was in full swing. It was pretty obvious that like mass adoption was, you know, coming, at least from the speculation phase in the next couple of years. So I wasn't afraid to be early. There was an obvious need, like, you know, 2017, 2018, 2019 going forward, that people were going to have to pay their taxes. Like, it's a matter of time before America figures out, you know, how it wants to address cryptocurrency taxes. It won't always be laissez-faire. And I think as there's more innovation and more adoption in utility tokens and security tokens, like, you know, it was very interesting to create a company that is doing like very basic infrastructure compliance, picks and shovels. Like, I'm not claiming to, you know, do the next generation of artificial intelligence on Ethereum, which is like 5 transactions per second and, you know, stuff like that. Like, we can develop software that works, you know, can get you to a very definitive like math answer, and, you know, just take care of customers, you know, and charge like a SaaS fee. It's kind of crazy. We don't need to do an ICO or STO for it.
Yeah, no, it's, what's the phrase? The only two things that are certain are death and taxes, right? Isn't that a phrase?
Yeah, I think that was Ben Franklin, but yeah.
So you're in the right industry, right? It's going to get taxed. So that was actually a question I had also. You know, you mentioned like Congress is probably going to need to write laws around how, you know, taxation of this stuff works. How are you building software around what seems like a moving target, right?
Yeah, so we've consulted with a lot of CPAs and tax litigation lawyers, specifically with accountants and lawyers that have stood in front of the IRS and represented clients about cryptocurrency. And there are certain things that are black and white, and then other things that are gray, and then there's aggressive and there's conservative. So we kind of build software that takes a first pass approach of saying like, hey, like, here's short-term and long-term capital gains. Here's how we establish a cost basis in each coin. We don't think 1031 exchanges will ever be defensible, so we're not going to build that into our tax logic at all. LIFO may be defensible, so we will build that in. So we have to make decisions like that. And then we listen to our customers too. As customers ask for more things, we, you know, we put in our product roadmap and get the features out as quickly as we can.
Is there exposure on your side? I mean, you're charging a SaaS fee, and I think the pricing was fairly nominal or reasonable. But if someone's taxes or you know, if someone gets sued by the IRS because their crypto tax payments are wrong, does that fall on your shoulders at all, or is it?
I think in general, how we treat it is we're going to do as much, you know, like math and accounting for you as we can. But in the end, we're not filing your taxes for you. Either you are as the individual or the CPA is. So you know, we want to be 100% accurate, and we believe we are being that doing that. But we don't represent ourselves as a, you know, like a CPA or, you know, anything like that. We're a SaaS company that's doing like useful math and accounting and data processing for you.
Makes sense. All right, two more like macro questions, and we'll get into fundraising, which is really what this is about. But you know, it seems like there's so much of crypto activity these days is speculative. As that subsides, if assuming it does, right? And crypto really becomes more of a utility versus an investment or speculative. Does this change the appetite for software like yours?
Yeah, I think so. I think it'll be kind of like the broader like traditional finance economy, where some of crypto is earned as income, just like some of fiat is earned as income and it's taxed a certain way. Then some of crypto will be earned as investment income, right? You'll place your bets, you'll buy equity like crypto. And it'll appreciate or depreciate in value, and there'll be tax consequences. But you know, a lot of the utility tokens we look at, it looks like income, and you know, mining activity is a mixture of income and then capital gains. It's a bit messy, but in any sense, I think that there's certain use cases and efficiencies in cryptocurrency that will take over. I don't think it's a cure all, and it'll reshape all governments and voting and everything, but you know, in supply chain, in things like being embedded in your browser and you getting compensated for your attention rather than you know, Facebook and Google, you know, charging advertisers for the attention they've already gathered, things like that make a lot of sense to me already. And then the ability to fractionate ownership, you know, we already do it with like government securities, actually. You can buy strips. So you can buy like the interest part of a government bond, and then you can buy the principal part of a government bond. And, you know, in traditional crypto, you should be able to do the same thing with security tokens. You can own a portion of real estate. You can own a portion of a company. You can own, you know, a revenue stream, insurance contracts, like all those same things are already being sorted out by computers, but just opaquely on a central exchange. So I can see where, you know, crypto can take a big portion of that market in the next 5 years.
Okay. All right. Last question. And if I'm trading in and out of Venezuela's petro crypto, can you track that?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, like whatever you want to disclose to the authorities is up to you again. So we prepare your taxes as best we can with the information you provide. But we don't, you know, no one forces you to divulge everything. You know, Benjamin Franklin's are like the dirtiest thing in the whole world, right? They're used in every country for all sorts of things. I don't think crypto is inherently, you know, dirty. And then nor is it inherently secure or unsecure, right? It depends on the person and how you transact, how much you can, you know, keep to yourself, I guess, of what you're doing.
Yeah. Cool. So you guys have raised fairly recently a seed round, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And how much was that? 1.7? Is that
accurate? 1.5 million we raised from two venture capital firms, Vestigo Ventures and Castle Island Ventures.
So tell us about raising that. How did you identify these firms? I'm not familiar with them personally, but like, how did you identify them? How did you approach them? You know, what was the appetite for something like what you're doing? It sounds pretty different and novel. I haven't heard of anything similar. So maybe talk us through the fundraising story.
Yeah, I'd say it comes from having a broad network and you know, the power of loose ties in your network. If you know your strong ties, if those people could help you, they would have already helped you. So where the help comes from in your network is the loose ties, like people who kind of know what you're up to, or you know through a friend of a friend, but you don't really know well, and you haven't really asked them, and they don't know about your problem. So we met with Vestigo because of an introduction from a business school friend of mine, Carl Muth, who's the CEO and founder of First.io, FRST. And he was pitching Vestigo. And after pitching them about his hedge fund, like crypto hedge fund execution software, he mentioned Zenledger. And then Vestigo, you know, Mark Cassidy is the CEO there. He said, well, that, you know, that kind of picks and shovels and blockchain sounds like exactly what we're interested in. So Vestigo had recently raised a $60 million fund. Castle Island had recently raised a $30 million fund. So that always helps when you're looking at VCs who is fresh up with capital that they can deploy and has investment thesis at what you're pointed at. So Vestigo's founders have deep experience in fintech, in asset management. You know, they are comfortable with SEC and the regulatory space, and they had made a couple other investments in blockchain, like picks and shovels companies. So, you know, this was like right up our alley, and so it seemed like a good fit. There was immediate interest from Vestigo, and they, you know, brought us in after a phone call, and we pitched them. And then once they had committed to the round, they had also committed to bringing on an investment partner and made the introduction to Castle Island. And Castle Island, their founders, Nick Carter and Matt Walsh had worked at Fidelity specifically on blockchain and strategy for the last 3 years. So it was great partners, great fit. But then also, you know, right time with the right business. So like all these things have to come together because the probability of getting funded is low. And so it's always happenstance in the end that is the trigger event, unless you're just like a founder with multiple exits, like doing the same thing over and over, and you already know who your investors are going to be before you start the business.
This is great. And is this the first startup you raised money for? Or have you raised for others? I know you've been part of other startups.
Yeah, this is the first startup where I was the guy, you know, going around doing the pitches. I think it's been many years of preparation. Like as a helicopter mission commander, I was standing up and doing the briefings and thinking through all the angles and how you're going to react. And then at business school, you do a lot of practice with this. We thought through ventures and had dabbled in things. And then obviously as an investment banker, you know, you're in the room, you're in the board of directors, you're preparing financial statements and learning how to give, high pressure presentations. So it was a long thing. It wasn't like I just read one book about how to pitch or like a couple like slide shares.
To a podcast about this. Suddenly you know what you're doing.
I think I'd known I'd wanted to be a CEO of my own company for a decade, and I've been preparing for it. And luckily I was good enough to meet whatever like minimum hurdle you have to get over to get funded at this time.
You don't look old enough to have done all that stuff, but that's.
I'm 38. I have 3 kids. Diet and exercise, right?
For anyone watching this on YouTube, right beforehand, he shaved, and maybe you should have kept the beard, make you look a little older.
If I'm a military founder of a company, I either need to have like a full special forces beard or I need to be clean shaven. I don't think I can do the Tom Brady 5 day thing. Right. I don't pull it off well.
I shave about once a week. Today was the day, so that you're catching me on a good day. Interesting. So these two funds, are they specifically crypto funds or are they more fintech funds that happen to do some crypto?
Yeah, so I'd say Castle Island is pretty focused on blockchain and crypto. Mm-hmm. And then Vestigo is more in fintech and blockchain. So they're happy to play in blockchain where it makes a lot of sense. But they're the founder understanding is more deeply in fintech. So their portfolio has a mix of both.
And are these the only two funds that you pitched, or did you go talk to 10, 20, 50?
Yeah, we went around. So our seed investors, those conversations were all very easy. We were lucky enough to be raising seed capital in like late December, early January. So Bitcoin was at 15,000-20,000, and it was very easy to get $25,000-50,000 investments from people in crypto who'd recently like saw their net worth go up a lot and had great connections and network, deep understanding of the space and the problem, as they were thinking to themselves like, man, how am I going to pay taxes on this stuff? Because they'd all made enough money that you can't hide, and you want to turn this crypto into dollars to turn into startup funding for your own startup. Like you need to, have rent, rent office space and things like that, compensate your own employees. So it wasn't like, these people were trying to hide. They were like, well, I'm going to have to pay taxes and I want to make sure I do it right. And we were able to assemble a really good team. It was about team, product, and market opportunity. And that's how we would walk investors through it.
Actually, go back to that seed round then. What was, because that's interesting timing, right? Bitcoin is at 15K. How did you find a group? How much did you raise and how did you find a group of angels, I guess?
Yeah, so we raised two trenches, really. So we got the backhand compliment that our valuation was very reasonable in December and January. We weren't asking for the moon. I can't disclose the terms; they're not public. We haven't priced the company. We're still on convertible notes. But we raised a very modest convertible note in December, January, and a modest amount of cash, about $300,000. And it was just a bet on ourselves, saying we're going to have a product out by tax season, or we'll fold up shop. Our team.
You had nothing. It was slideware, basically, at that point. Team and slideware.
Yeah. Yeah, and so our team is, and the problem we were addressing was what made it. So our CTO, Brian Starbuck, has been 10 years at Microsoft. He was on the Internet Explorer team that killed Netscape. And then he was on, Windows hardening teams, like security hardening teams. And then 10 years in his own startups with multiple exits and always managing, large teams of developers. Drew Nordstrom is a JD MBA. I'm an MBA. Saqib Rasool was also 10 years at Microsoft and 10 years in his own startups. And so it was a very good core team, and we were quickly able to bring on, good seed investors and advisors because of that. And we weren't pitching something scammy. We weren't, saying, look, this is a classic pump and dump. I'm going to sell these to you for 10 cents. In 2 weeks, we're going to sell them for $1 and, dump it on the market. Like, that's not what we were doing. And that was refreshing to our investors as well. Like, they could see that we were, just going to try to do things on the up and up. So then we got a product out by late March, had a successful run where, in 10 weeks, we coded it up and marketed it pretty well, had several hundred customers go through and give us really valuable product feedback. We just had it for free because we did a very limited offering on only 6 exchanges of integrations. And then based on that, we were able to raise another $500,000 from angel investors on better terms. And that was going to get us through to next April. But then, in a very different market too, right? So raising, capital in, May, June of this year, very, very different market. But the fact that we'd built a product, we kept the team together, we'd been doing, high integrity, like marketing, and people kind of knew about us and saw us, helped us raise the additional funding and set us up to, raise capital from the venture capital firms.
Okay, that's a nice quick, you raise 300K on team and slideware, you build the product by March, get a couple hundred customers, raise another 500K by May, and then jump to the VC route. That's an aggressive timeline, but I guess that's your military training, right?
Didn't feel aggressive to me. It just kind of felt like what needed to be done and what was within the realm of possibility. If it wasn't possible, we wouldn't have tried to pull it off, but it kind of felt like it was there to do. We were planning to run on a very lean budget if we had it through April, and then once we were able to secure capital, we said, okay, we're in growth mode. We're good through tax season 2020. Let's put our foot on the gas.
So that 500K in May, Bitcoin's obviously come down since the 15K mark, or the high was 20, right? Something like that.
Yeah, like peaked at like 19 something, yeah, I think.
So Bitcoin is, I don't know where it was in May, but definitely, half that or less, right? Yeah. So did the folks you had gone to before when it was at a high, kind of say, hey, I'm worth half what I was before, I can't follow on, or was there still appetite for that?
I mean, a couple investors re-upped. Most were just like, look, I only do like very early stage, and my net worth has been shredded by 70%. So like, I didn't ask most of those people. You have to have a feel for the market, right? And I remember like specifically saying like, oh, we can't go after people who are only crypto wealthy. We have to go after people who are US dollar wealthy at this point for investment.
Yeah. I can definitely see the pitch being, we're doing this on the up and up, not spammy, scammy. It's all picks and shovels for this massive new market, which is, appealing to a lot of investors, I think. I mean, did you get pushback? All those are really compelling. Did you get pushback of like, what happens when TurboTax or Quicken says we're building this? I mean, you built something in 3 months, which is amazing. So what was the competitive,
Yeah. I'd say, we got at least 100 no's, either firm no's or, deafening silence, right? And that's just like kind of what you put up with. I'd say that, the pointed questions of will TurboTax do this? And our reply was always, no, like they could have built mint.com. They could have built, T-Sheets, which is another recent, $100 million acquisition from Intuit. Like they're not in the business of starting, new ventures de novo. They're in the business of borrowing money at 0% interest rates and acquiring customer bases and working teams. You know, like no VP at Intuit is going to ask for a 2-year runway and a $20 million budget to hire 20 people and see if there's a market here.
Yeah, that's true. You're right. I know you say frame it like that. I went to Quicken's conference and there were hundreds of startups building around the platform, all of them likely acquisition targets or possible acquisition targets. Cool. So you said you got 100 no's. So I guess this is the VC round now. You're pitching a larger top of the funnel.
Yeah. So our seed investors, some of them were LPs in venture firms. So that helped. I had connections from, you know, business school, the other founders in the company also had connections. So we were able to get very good introductions. Sometimes the VC had already invested a competitor. Other times they just weren't interested in the space. And then I think, you know, early first half 2018, a lot of them were also thinking, oh, we can still do the instant liquidity from ICOs type thing. Why would we, you know, invest in a company that may, you know, like never be a $1 billion company? And we never pitched ourselves as a future $1 billion company. That's like, that's not how we go about it.
I feel like everyone has to pitch that they're going to be a $1 billion company, or
that crap's completely silly. Most companies will never be a $1 million company, let alone a $1 billion company. I think we showed a very tangible path to 5, 10, 20 million revenue. And you know, if we execute well, we're an incredibly profitable business and there'll be other places to grow as the market evolves. And if not, there'll be, you know, acquisition opportunities. Like everything depends on how well we execute, but most companies never IPO, right? So a success is getting acquired. And, you know, especially when you're in kind of the B2B picks and shovel space, and you should just kind of know what kind of business you're building and who your investors are and what they're interested in investing in.
You know, if you don't or not sure you're going to be a $1 billion business, or at least, you know, giving that party line, do you take a more capital conservative approach to fundraising? Or I guess the other way to ask that question is, how are you thinking about raising money going forward? Are you going to be pretty conservative, or as soon as you kind of see the light of day, you're going to raise as much as possible? Any thoughts on that?
No, I mean, I think the markets are going to have to dictate that. Like, I don't think anyone would be surprised if we had another major financial downturn in the next 2 years. And I should, you know, as a military guy, again, like, plan for the worst. I'm not going to plan for another dollar coming in the company. We're going to have to earn all of it. If that isn't the case, if we're in like a PayPal like growth mode and we can just like shove $100 million into the company, great. Like, I'll figure out how to succeed in a capital rich environment. I think you should definitely plan for the low resource environment first and, you know, grow your business there.
I feel like I wrote a blog post called like What Startups Can Learn from Sailors, and it was all these little lessons learned. I feel like you could probably have a blog post like What Startups Can Learn from, you know, Helicopter Military Planning, something like that. I feel like you have some lessons there. One or two more questions, I'll let you get back to business, but like anything you would do differently if you were starting this all over again, anything you would do differently on the fundraising side, or any just general tips and guidance for folks watching this that we haven't really covered?
I would say that if you ever are in a situation like, you know, the year 1999 or crypto late 2017, and you see asset values go asymptotic and everyone's quite, you know, rich, raise as much money as you can in that environment, because the music will likely stop and you'll have to survive several years before you raise again. And that's just like my single data point. I'm sure that, you know, Airbnb would say one thing, Amazon would say another. Some general advice I would have is don't be in too much of a rush to be a founder. Like, I think the real advice is the 22 or 25 year old mostly doesn't know how to do anything very well. Like, and if you're competing against people, like, you're competing against experience. And sometimes it's useful not to compete against experience. Sometimes it's useful to have a lot of experience. I think in crypto, there's a lot less barriers. But you see already the people who now are raising money and building things have deep experience in other places, 20 years in other places. So I think the longer term smarter path is to keep finding the best people to learn from. If in your heart you absolutely know you're a founder, go for it. But just don't be surprised when it fails. I'm not gonna be surprised when this fails. This is not my first startup. It's not my last startup. There's a 90% chance it can fail, even though we're funded. And I'm like sanguine about that. You know, be in it for like the very long game, right? Don't think that any individual or immediate short-term success or failure holds more significance. Like, I got a lot of no's, I got a lot of almost yeses, I got enough yeses to keep us in the game. And I noticed that I wasn't having nearly as many emotional ups and downs as people generally talk about. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because I'm a bit older. I have a bunch of, you know, training and how to think through stress. And I've had just a ton of experiences on stressful situations, and none of this is life and death. It's just like a new learning education. You can think of it as a game if that helps you. You can think of it as mountain climbing or whatnot, but, you know, just don't think that success will be immediate, and, you know, capitalize on your strengths, shore up your weaknesses, you know, do all of it, because you don't know like when it'll pay off.
Anything you find yourself coming back to from your military days? I think this could be an interesting question too, right? Anything you find yourself sort of like reminding yourself or coming back to, like you said, none of this is life and death, but anything else that you like really hold dear from military days as you're doing the startup? I think this could be cool for any vets watching this.
I mean, so have confidence that you can learn, right? So this goes for vets and non-vets. I think vets will be in the situation where it's not very entrepreneurial. It's adventurous, but it's not like I have a customer, I have to provide a product or service that earns, you know, their dollars. And then, but veterans can, you know, it might take you 5 years, but you can learn the finance, the marketing, the legal, the business strategy. I hopped from an underground chemistry into learning how to fly, into finance and accounting, into tech. But it took time, right? It took a good amount of time. And I'm not a coder or anything. I just kind of understand what is possible in tech. I can talk to a CTO. I can talk to devs. I can give feedback on, you know, UI, UX, and wireframes, but can't do any of it myself. So just that confidence that, you know, sound decision-making makes sense, but you also have to learn how to make decisions in a different field. So the benefits and consequences are different in business than in combat. And so I find that a lot of people think that bankruptcy is death, and then some financial success ensures, you know, success forever, right? Neither are true. You can bounce back from the lows, and the highs can be very temporary. So I'd say, you know, like control your breathing, control your emotions. Notice when you're having like an adrenaline reaction to an email you don't like or a stressful situation. Just kind of like chill out. Most things in business, you don't have to make immediate decisions. Sometimes you do, and then, you know, just be thoughtful and make the right decisions in the moment. But other times, like, you can let it sit for a day. Don't let it sit for a week or a month or a year or anything, in most cases. But there's a lot of things you can take from the military. Like, it all rhymes. But it's also just like you're going to have to dive into business, right? You know, business people read all sorts of, you know, Sun Tzu and whatever. And I think it's just that everyone needs to learn from everywhere, because the competition is fierce, and sometimes very, very little differences can make you know, the results like completely change.
Just one last question: is there anything you think vets need to unlearn? Is there any common things that vets need to unlearn as they go into startup entrepreneurial battlefield?
I mean, it's just a completely different world. Like, working in investment banking and Amazon was completely different than being in the military. I'm also not the best person to comment on like a military mindset, because I don't fit well in large organizations. Like, I was very happy in a small helicopter, and I'm very happy in startups. And I'm a traditional malcontent when it comes to being in large organizations. So I just never quite thought of myself as like an organizational man, like a big company guy who follows every rule. Like, I generally instantly see the hypocrisy or this rule is aimed at this lowest common denominator that I'm not a part of, and I naturally rebel against that stuff, for better or for worse. So that's kind of my take on things. Like if you really like making your own decisions and you don't mind taking risks and you like learning, then entrepreneurship's a good path.
Yeah. And okay. That's interesting. Do you think there's sort of the rigidity of military maybe has to be unwound when you go into a startup? Cause it's, I mean, even with my startup, it's changing every 3 days, you know, it's very fluid. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it completely depends on who you are going into it. Some of it's track dependent. I think I was playing sports and driving cars fast and learning on my own before I got into the military, and I continued to do that after. Some people, like I've talked to hedge fund managers who said, oh, I hired a bunch of submarine, you know, nuclear engineers, and they weren't very good at making trades. And I was like, well, because those people follow checklists. Like they're incredibly smart. They are great at math. But they follow procedures specifically, because if you don't, then very bad things happen on nuclear submarines. Right? Whereas, you know, pilots, you're freelancing, right? Like once you go out there, you're making your own decisions. The situation changes dynamically, especially, you know, in combat situations. And so you constantly have to be updating your information. You're going to make that final decision. You have to trust other people. If some 18-year-old with 6 months of training who's sitting 3 feet behind me and looking out to the right says, hey, break left, I'm just going to listen immediately. I have to trust teammates. So those are different things. Like kind of know what you were trained for and, you know, try to pick a career that's going to benefit that, or, you know, identify what might be bad habits and try to unlearn them. Like my bad habits are, that I don't fit well inside larger organizations. And it led to a lot of pain and angst anytime I was working in one of those companies. But that's where the jobs are, and that's where the compensation is good.
One of the definitions of an entrepreneur is someone who is unemployable. That's like, you know, one of those little cliches. Very good. All right, I'll let you get back to it. You've got work to do. But if anyone wants to learn more, it's simply zenledger.io, right?
Yeah, we're currently hiring, so you know, reach out to us. We're hiring a UX designer right now. We're always looking for talented developers and marketers as well. We're building out our marketing team, so feel free to visit our website if you're interested in a Seattle-based startup, or if you need some help with your cryptocurrency taxes.
Cool. All right. I have not got into crypto trading. It's sort of, my wife is like, we're already overexposed to risky assets with startups. So we haven't done that. So I'm not a customer candidate right now, but maybe down the road. So, all right. Thank you, Pat. This has been great. And best of luck. We'll catch you after your next round.